Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 329. I'm joined this week by Simon Bird of The Inbetweeners, of Friday Night Dinner, and I was excited to discuss his directorial debut, Days of the Bagnold Summer, which blew me away. I got a preview link screening thing recently, and it was, it's wonderful. It's out now. It's on, like, Prime Video to rent or buy, and on Sky Demand to rent or buy, and all that kind of thing. All those places, and I recommend it. You'll hear a load about it, so I won't ramble on too much now. Thank you for all the love for the recent episodes. Obviously, last week was a three-part isolation drunk cast, where we talked about some heavy stuff, but we also talked about arguably the best game ever invented. And it's one of my favourite conversations of all time, the prank game that Chris put forward, and the direction in which it went was a lot of fun. And the week before, obviously, we reissued the Killer Mike and the Akala episodes, and there's been a lot of love and a lot of continued sharing for them because they feel very relevant right now. Speaking of right now, there's going to be a bonus episode on Friday where I'm talking to a professor and a doctor, both in the kind of social sciences areas, about the Defund the Police movement. It's something that's being talked about a lot online at the moment. So I wanted to look into it more because I thought it sounded interesting. I didn't know if it sounded good or bad. As soon as I looked into it, I realised there's so much more depth to it than what the name sounds like, if that makes sense. So I decided, rather than rambling on about it myself, I wanted to educate myself, and I thought, why not educate some others as well? So yeah, I got two experts on it. It took a lot of digging and hunting. What I love about the academic world is that they're not like podcasters, and they won't just talk on something they don't know anything about. So I hit up a few different people I know who recommended other people who felt that they weren't qualified to recommend other people who felt that they weren't qualified to recommend other people until I found the people who were the exact right people to talk to. So that's exciting. That's going to be out on Friday. It's going to be really interesting. So tune into that with an open mind. And whether you're in support or against what you perceive the Defund the Police movement to be. Again, you could be supporting it, thinking it's something that it completely isn't. You could be against it, thinking it's something that it completely isn't. I know I've heard it mentioned on a lot of podcasts. And the typical arguments are what you're going to do when someone gets shot or someone gets raped and there's no police. Turns out that wouldn't be an issue. But that'll all be explained. That's not an argument against it. There are arguments against it, and we will discuss all of these things. But that's actually one that I thought, well, come on. And then, yeah, there's a lot more to it. And also I'm speaking to an expert in America and an expert in the UK to talk about the differences between the countries and if it's viable or not viable. And it is different situations and different answers. So yeah, anyway, that's going to be on Friday. And then, yeah, loads of good episodes to come. So on with this one. Thank you, as ever, for tuning in. I'd never met or spoken to Simon Bird before. We recorded this over Zoom. And, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. He's a lovely guy, a very funny guy, as expected, and a very honest and open guy. So, yeah, let's just get into it. This is episode 329 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And that is perfect, and we are rolling. I'm joined today by Simon Bird. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks. How's it going?
It's good. It's interesting times. How are you finding...
It is interesting times,
yeah,
isn't
to be mild, to play it really lightly. How are you finding parenting and gearing up to promote a film during a pandemic? That's a hell of a triple.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah. It's awful, obviously.
I can imagine.
I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so there's been on. Yeah. I mean, I'm not even. I'm not even thinking about the film. It's been all about sort of keeping them entertained. Yeah, they're voracious in terms of the parental attention. they feed off it. So yeah, it's been a long few months.
It's a crazy one because. I mean, we'll talk about it more as we go on, because the film industry in general pleads ignorance to the existence of families. It kind of makes demands on your time regardless of your... or attempts to make demands on your time regardless of your situation. But this is your directorial debut, so this will be something that you've built up to for a long time. Is there stress or is there relief to kind of have to go, well, there's more important things in the world... You know, and not be able to have that focus that you may have been pressured to have on it otherwise.
Oh yeah, I think definitely relief. And I think, to be honest, I'm over the film anyway. You know, I was over it as soon as it was finished. I'd sort of forgotten it existed. No, I'm being facetious. Obviously, it's obviously great and exciting that it's coming out, but definitely like it's not the primary thing I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be, to be honest, even if there wasn't a global pandemic to keep us all, you know, on the edge of our seats. Cause I think that's just the way the industry works as well, is you have to sort of move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You've got to be constantly trying to make things happen. So, yeah, for me, this, you know, we finished the film over a year ago, so... It coming out is just like, it's like the final box to tick, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird with, I mean, I discuss this all the time on here. It's weird with the nature of promo because exactly as you said, each project can be really kind of all-consuming, but you move on as soon as it finishes. It's been the weirdest thing for me. I moved into acting 4 or 5 years ago now, and it's so fascinating because you have these 4 or 5 months of the most intense relationships because you're with these same people every day in intimate situations at points, and then it ends. And see you later. And if you're keeping busy, you're into that same relationship with completely new set of people over here all of a sudden.
Totally, yeah. So, I'm sure there might be the odd WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
That will pop up every once in a while. But yeah, it's that is strange. And you'll maybe retain like one or two friends from each thing that you've been on.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sort of camaraderie, like, we'll never forget this.
Yeah.
And then the week after, it's all is instantly forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I should mention that the film is called Days of Bagnold Summer. I absolutely adored it. And it was a really... surreal watch for me because I grew up in Essex with a mum who was a librarian and a brother who was a metaller, and that's essentially what the story is. It's a mum and my parents were separated, so this was really kind of going. This is getting weirder and weirder as it goes on.
It's a biopic. I should have mentioned it. It's a biopic.
The dark thing is, it's a biopic with me removed. it's a biopic of my mum and brother without me.
Yeah, look, you weren't going to be featured. That was... we never considered that, to be honest.
So what drew you... Because it's from a graphic novel, it's adapted as a script. What drew you to the story and this project, I guess, as your step into directing?
Good question. I mean, actually, I think the story was the one thing where I was like... Ooh, I'm not sure about this because it's there are definite overlaps with The Inbetweeners and the things that I'm sort of famous for, I guess. And I obviously wanted to try and move away from that slightly. So the idea of doing something about a teenager growing up in suburbia was not top of my agenda.
Yeah,
but I just thought that the book was so funny and so honest and so well observed and so poignant that I sort of kept coming back to it. And, you know, that I knew that I wanted to make a film that was in that sort of tonal territory, and it was British and it was contemporary, and I thought it would be quite cheap to make. So all those sort of things made it ultimately unavoidable.
It's fascinating...
the reality of that process, that you do have to kind of look and go, right, well, as a kid, you might think the film I want to direct is this sci-fi and it's this and it's that. And realistically, particularly for first-time writers or directors, you're often not going to get that huge budget, we can do everything. And to be frank, you're not going to be qualified to direct that, because you're not going to have the experience. So
I'm not qualified to do anything.
Exactly. So the kind of the beauty is to go, right, well, this feels like I can do this really well. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's affordable, it's achievable. It feels, I look at it and I don't see anything that makes me go, I'd do this if I could phone a friend of Steven Spielberg or whomever else to tell me how to do it. But this feels like I can do that. So it's interesting that part comes into the realistic process rather than the dream process.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it sounds massively cynical, but it's that was a big factor. It just felt totally manageable. Yeah, both in terms of my skill set and, you know, I've only ever been in TV programs that are set in, like, here and now.
Yeah.
So I've never seen directors or directors of photography have to do stuff that, you know, have to do sort of special effects and all that sort of stuff. I have no experience of that. Luckily, I think that overlaps with the sort of stories that I like to, the sort of films that I like to watch. So it's sort of, yeah, it all came together, but definitely it was part of the thinking.
One of the things that I came out of this just raving about was Monica Dolan. Her performance is just fantastic. I was aware of her from Mid Morning Matters and Alpha Papa and Pride, but seeing her in this more lead role that has a lot of nuance. It's a beautiful role because you get to see, and again, it sounds so simple, but it's something that you will have experienced in day to day life. You get to see her as mum, and you get to see her as not mum, and you get to see the overlap and the crossover and the balancing between the two, I guess. How was that to work with her and to see that performance unfold and to draw it out, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, she's a pro.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was amazing. But I knew she would be, because I'd seen her in so much stuff. And, you know, the reason I think she jumped out at me was that she just moves very effortlessly from drama to comedy. You know, she's won a BAFTA for playing Rose West.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like you say, the next year she's in Alpha Papa. So, yeah, she can do it all, really. So I knew that she'd be able to bring a sort of a depth and realness to it. Yeah, she's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's exactly that transition, because on the surface it feels at first as she's playing almost your stereotypical mum. Here's a mum in a story, and then it's the layers and the emotion in certain scenes. It's heartbreaking. It brings that realism into the room, I guess.
Well, I'm glad that's the case. I think that was another fear I had with the book, is that it's literally, because it's from a graphic novel, that they are literally cartoons.
It feels
you start the book and you're like, oh, I've seen this before. It's, you know, the librarian and the metalhead feels like, you know, archetypes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope there's a bit more sort of subtlety to it than that. And yeah, we definitely needed somebody of her quality to bring that out.
Was there an element of, again, I'm thinking of the realisticness of your own approach to this. Was there an element of knowing that your directorial debut would be a lot easier with a cast of people like Monica Dolan, Rob Brydon, Alice Lowe, Tamsin Grigg, Tim Key, all these people who, as you said, with Monica, they're just absolute pros. They know what they're doing and they're all, they're fantastic. Did that give you some relief?
Totally. I think there are two elements to that, really. One was with Monica was, like, I was amazed that she... I think we were casting it around the time that basically, like, Olivia Colman had just won an Oscar. Yeah. And I just looked at Monica and thought, like, oh, she's somebody that could easily make that step up.
Yeah.
You know, she's somebody that people sort of recognise but don't necessarily know her name. She's been amazing in all these great British sitcoms. So I thought she would invariably do films soon, and I just wanted to basically steal a march and get in there early. And then with the rest of the cast, yeah, I mean, part of it is like, well, no, the whole thing is getting people who are great at their job. Like, that's the whole joy of directing it. It's like, what an amazing privilege to be like, be able to pick your sort of dream team.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was just amazed that all those people were up for doing it.
The two that I wasn't familiar with, but that were absolutely blown away by, was the kind of co-lead, Earl Cave, and most of all, the show stealer for me was Elliot Spencer. Is it Agillo?
Elliot Speller Gillett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just, every time he was on screen, I just couldn't look away. And it was such, again, it was such a big cartoony character, yet so real. And again, I've grown up with people like that. And yeah. It was, yeah, he felt amazing. Both of them felt amazing.
It was a really hard part, that one, because it's like you say, in the book, so this is this character, Kai, who's like Daniel, the main kid's best friend. And he is just, he's sort of this, he models himself after a sort of Viking. And he has a sort of range of hats that he wears. He's like a total sort of self-styled freak, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's something of the, like, something of the Russell Brand about him almost. And yeah, if you don't get that right, it feels very forced and like you're trying to be funny rather than it being based in truth.
Yeah.
But definitely my experience was I knew kids like that at school. So, yeah, he absolutely nails it in the book. And it was very, very hard bring it to life, but Elliot did an amazing job. And Earl, like you say, in the sort of part as Daniel, was just a great find, because he... that's a really hard part as well, in that it's like he's the centre of the film, but he's supposed to be this sort of sad, quiet, introverted kid who's sort of in a sulk for 95% of the film. And so that doesn't sound very watchable. You need the audience to like him and be rooting for him, and it's hard to pull that off. But he just has a sort of... I think he's going to be an absolutely huge star. He's got a real sort of magnetism to him. And underneath the sort of, the moody exterior, you could just see that he's such a sweetheart. And yeah, he is in real life. He's just the nicest kid.
But again, I think it's... They're both characters that are so, as you say, they're so cartoon. And they, in a way, they're so forced and fake, but that's because that's the role that teenagers are playing. Teenagers don't know totally who they are, so they're playing the role, and he does it perfectly, of playing the role of an angry, scary metaller, and then every now and then you just see him crack a little bit, and you realise he's like, oh, am I playing this role right? As the character, I mean. Am I playing this right? Am I... When he's offered weed at one point and things like that. And again, I remember years of growing up claiming that with my other friends, who were completely fictional, I did loads of drugs, I did loads of this and loads of that. Yet, any time you actually confront, you're like, no, I'm probably all right today. And again, it's like, they are playing characters.
I had loads earlier for breakfast.
So, exactly.
No, I'm going to take the afternoon off, actually.
So, yeah, it's such a perfect and a delicate role to play, because you are playing an unrealistic role, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You've got to play... someone, it sounds like a weird comparison, but it makes me think of DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he had to be an actor playing an actor who's a bad actor. So at points, there's so many levels of what he's playing that it could get confusing.
Yeah.
But it's nailed. It's wonderful to watch.
Well, I'm glad. I don't think he'll mind being compared to DiCaprio either.
It's not bad.
This has all gone very well.
So it had me thinking afterwards, where was your upbringing? Was it more here, or was it more in between us, or was it somewhere in between or somewhere completely different?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I think I'd be lying if I said there weren't quite major overlaps with the in-betweeners. You know, I didn't I didn't have a briefcase, but I did. I had a violin case. So yeah, I mean, I was not one of the cool set, and I definitely wasn't a metalhead. But I think that definitely there's like, I think what's good about Daniel in the film is that like, I hope that character is relatable to everyone. I mean, like you say, the metal is, that's just a sort of uniform that he's trying on. Like, yeah. It's not, I don't really believe he's that into Metallica.
Yeah.
And I think we've all been through that as teenagers. And it's about trying to find like your own, stake your own claim away from your parents. And that sort of weird realization that your parents are their own people and have their own sort of internal emotional lives. And that, you come to that realization weirdly, just as you're sort of thinking about leaving the house and leaving home. So yeah, I think for that reason, I definitely see parts of myself in Daniel as well.
Yeah. Has that realization been drilled home a bit by becoming a parent? I always remember Joe Rogan had a really good bit in his stand-up that he'd talk about the point in life he realised that there's no such thing as grown-ups, that we're all just as clued, that we assume our parents know, they've got it all figured out and they know all the answers, and then we become them and go, oh, they didn't know anything either.
They were
stumbling along too.
I mean, yeah, that it's huge when you sort of realise that, isn't it? It changes your perception of everything. I mean, and suddenly you find yourself in a global pandemic and you realise, oh, right, so the government actually have literally no idea what they're doing. And everyone's lives are at stake. Becoming a parent is definitely, I've definitely realised that. I think we sort of made the film just as our first kid had been born, and we were, because my wife wrote the screenplay, and she was pregnant with our second kid. And I think we sort of realised we were basically equidistant between Daniel, who's 15 in the film, and Sue, who's 55. And, so I think that probably sort of fed into it a little bit. Because that was a big part of what I loved about the book, and what we tried to do with the film was make it totally even-handed. There's absolutely as much Sue's story as it is Daniel's. It's really about the relationship between the two and how, you know, the actions of one invariably affects the other. So I guess on some subconscious level, that must have been, going on.
Yeah, yeah. Relating to both characters in that way. How was it working with your wife on a project?
I like her personally, so, I've got time for her. Yeah, it was good. Again, it was something we like really tried to avoid, actually, because we thought it would, not just us, but the producers and the financiers and everyone thought it was a terrible idea, which I can fully understand. But ultimately, it made so much sense because most importantly, because she's just an amazing writer, but also just because we obviously had such shorthand in the way we like, speak to each other and communicate. And we've also just spent like the last 15 years watching films together and have,
of course,
we have very similar taste and sensibility. And I think, I trusted her more than anyone that she wouldn't go away and write a script that I personally hated.
Yeah.
Which is always sort of the biggest fear when you're a director, is getting a script and being like, oh, I'm not convinced by this.
I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I'm not happy. That's perfect, though. And it's really interesting because a lot of people, I know Louis Theroux has talked about, he and his wife avoided working together for a long time, and then they finally started working together and went, oh, why were we avoiding this? Like, we know each other really well. There's a greater understanding from the family perspective when it's a project that we've both worked on, and we know, if one of us needs to be away working on it, we're both so involved that we understand it more. There's not that resentment.
That actually is a really good point, and that did make a big difference. Yeah. Because when I was filming, I was away for a month, and she was here with two young kids.
Yeah.
And yeah, she just couldn't be annoyed about it. Yeah. So it was great. Yeah. It was the perfect crime.
You sent me here.
Yeah. I mean, also like today, to be honest, I've kicked her out of the house. And here I am, lounging on my bed.
Amazing.
Having a great time.
Amazing. So, I mean, you touched upon how you kind of realise parents have their own lives when you leave home. You went to Cambridge, and that was a key part of your upbringing, because in the Footlights you met Joe, who's also in the Inbetweeners, right?
Yeah.
One of my favourite things. I've never been in the Footlights. I've never experienced it, but I love the stories about it, just because I'm always excited to ask who was in the Footlights year above you. Because at school, the year above you kids are always the cooler kids, the people you look up to and all that kind of thing. Yet, because of the Footlights, we're generally going to all have heard who they are, and they're going to have gone on to have these careers in comedy. So who was in the year above, and how were they perceived?
Yeah, I mean, I remember this first week of being at Cambridge, the Footlights show from the year before comes back to Cambridge.
Yeah.
They've just done the Edinburgh Festival, and they come back and do the show from last year. So I went to see that, and that was this show called Non-Sexual Kissing. I'm now trying to remember everyone in it, but I will fail to do that. But it was directed by, I think, by Tim Key and Mark Watson, and Stefan Goloszewski and Tom Basden, and I think Sarah Soleimani were all in it. So yeah, that was obviously great.
Yeah.
But it was amazing to see that, but it also doesn't really have any effect on you, because then you meet the people who want to do Footlights in your year, and you're just like 18-year-old kids who have never really done live comedy before,
yeah,
and are therefore very, very bad at it. So that, I mean, watching that tour show still felt like a very alien world. I was convinced they would go on and have careers in professional comedy, but it didn't seem like something that was realistic for me and Joe and Johnny Sweet and Nick Mohammed and all my friends in my year.
Yeah. So how was it? I mean, the first person I messaged after watching your film was Tim Key, because I thought he popped up out of nowhere. He was excellent. He came back saying how much he loved the film, which, you know, when people are talking privately, that's not always the case. You know,
yeah,
people can be quite open to go, oh yeah, particularly if you're only in a couple of scenes, it's quite easy to go.
But equally, when people are talking publicly, it's very common for people to lie. So yeah, there's no way that I could know that you're telling the truth here.
But Tim,
I appreciate
Tim
it's a good lie.
Tim is one as well who is so good and works so much. And again, it's a similar thing from when I used to make music. Is I'll have people who know an album inside and out, and it'll be weird to me because I'd made that album, and I've not listened to it since, because I don't sit here listening to my own records, so it doesn't mean as much to me. And Tim is one that I've had stuff before where I've gone, I watched this the other night, and he'll look at me a bit blankly. I go, you're in it. So, oh, am I?
And you're the main part.
He won't realise he's in it or part of it, but this was one he spoke warmly of. How was it to direct someone from the previous Footlights? Did that come to mind at all, that you were like, oh, I'm in charge of the grown-ups now, or the big boys.
I guess to some extent he's obviously like just such an incredible once in a generation comedy talent that I was very excited that he was up for being in it. I don't think I was thinking about it in terms of Footlights, really, just in terms of I'm just a huge fan of his stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was great, and that day was really fun, and it was unlike the rest of the day. I mean, everyone else in the film, or most of them, are sort of, I think, actors rather than comedians first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I guess maybe it is a Footlights thing ultimately, but I just love Tim's stuff so much that we sort of just let him get on with it. You know, that was really the only day where there was any sort of improv, and yeah, there was a lot of laughter. I ruined a lot of takes personally by bursting out laughing.
I completely understand. I had Tim on the podcast, and it's one of my favourites, but it's one of the hardest to do because I'm similar. I'm just such a fan of his work and his style. He can say almost anything, and I'll be giggling because it is all in the way he delivers it and the way his pauses and all that kind of thing. So I can completely imagine on set that there's points that you're ruining takes.
In many ways, it's disastrous. Yeah. It's very deeply unprofessional of him.
So, I mean, we've touched upon In-Betweeners, and I also want to talk about A Friday Night Dinner as well, but In-Betweeners as a starting point, that did thrust you into the forefront and into stardom quite quickly. It was very early in your career, and it was something that, again, it's odd comparison, but I remember talking to a few of the Game of Thrones guys who all hadn't really done anything before that, and then they signed on to some show early in their career, like, all right, we'll give this a go, and then that was 10 years of their life committed. How was that for you to be suddenly part of this thing and have that, number one, the sudden success, and number two, the sudden realisation maybe that this is your life for an extended period, you know?
Yeah, I think, like, the first thing to say is that obviously I wouldn't change it, and it's like, what an amazing opportunity it was, and I'm so glad to have done it. And it's, you know, obviously people ask me, isn't it really annoying to have people shout catchphrases at you all the time? But I take that as being very sort of humbling. It just means that people love the show and love what we did. So that side of it is great, obviously. But equally, you're right that it feels like, I guess there was a part of me that I never came into this industry thinking really that I wanted to be an actor. I came into it as a comedian. Mm. And I think the thing about comedy, what's great about it is being creative and getting to, like, write stuff and perform your own stuff and put your own material out there. And suddenly it felt harder to do that because I think people assumed that, to a certain extent, I was the character from The Inbetweeners, or at least certainly that I represented that sense of humour and that that was my personal style. I think there's still to this day people, I think, assume that I was involved in writing it in some way. And I love The Inbetweeners, and I love Ian and Damon's writing, but it's not the show that I personally would have written.
Of course.
So I think definitely, like, I felt slightly, obviously there'll be people listening who'll say that there's nothing to complain about, and it isn't anything to complain about, because obviously it opened lots of doors, and I'm well aware that I would never be able to have directed a film if I, without, you know, some quote-unquote celebrity status behind me to help raise the money to do that. But equally, I'm going to, you know, I'm trying to now forge my own path and make stuff that, you know, that I have the final creative say over.
Because
I think my path that I thought coming out of university was I'll really try and give comedy a go, and that means that I'll, you know, probably try and do a stand-up show in Edinburgh, and I'll keep doing sketch shows in Edinburgh, and I'll sort of find my voice, to sound pretentious, and hopefully, you know, build some sort of career. But then, yeah, The In-Betweeners happened so suddenly and so quickly that really I was moved into the world of acting rather than stand-up and sketches.
Yeah.
And at some point, it's taken a while, but I'm, you know, trying to sort of restate my claim to doing my own thing.
And I love that. And I think it's key to mention that Days of Bagnold Summer isn't In-Betweeners vibe and comedy. It's more along the lines of films like Submarine or even British version of films like Ghost Town and that kind of thing, where it is this more subtle and observational sitting with a family and then finding the humour, rather than here's the joke, someone's wet themselves, and so on and so forth. Which, again, is humour I love.
Someone's having a wank.
In-Betweeners is a great example of when it came out, I remember it coming out and thinking, oh, this sounds shit, it's not going to be my kind of thing. And I watched a couple of episodes and became a massive fan, because it was, in spite of me feeling I was arty and all these other things, good humour is good humour. So there's space for all of them. And I'm sure that must have been a thing for you that you're like, well, this is just great writing. But then, as you've said, at some point you go, well, this isn't what I want to do for my whole life. This isn't my writing, if you know what I mean. Yeah. You know, so we live in a time of untethered outrage where we are furious about the smallest thing. And then I think it's like, because of social media, it's like the Big Brother house, where people, the biggest drama in the world will be that someone's eaten their bag of crisps, someone else's bag of crisps, and then the next day...
Wait, who's crisps?
Exactly.
That does sound quite big, actually.
And then the next day, the big drama will be actual real-life racism, and they'll be the same level of fury. So with that in mind, how was it doing Friends Reunited? Because that was just a nice little reuniting of the cast and crew, and the outrage that it met was kind of unbelievable. Like, particularly where we're sitting now with all the different things that people are rightfully outraged about, it seems crazy that there was such an uproar to a nice idea of people meeting up again. Do you remember this show? Yeah. How dare you? What? How dare you remember?
I'm not on social media just because I find it too stressful for all the reasons you've mentioned there. I sort of missed that wave of outrage that you're now dredging up. Thank you very much.
There must have been a group message. You're not telling me there wasn't a group message.
I knew what was going on. And to be honest, I thought it was absolutely justified. I mean, we had... That show was a disaster, I thought. But we knew that as we were recording it. And we knew it as when it was suggested. We all said, no, this is a terrible idea. But there was real, real pressure from Channel 4 and the production company to do it. They all said, what you said, that it's harmless, it's just get you guys back together and we'll record it. But, you know, that's just not the way things work, is it? It turns out. And it was a valuable lesson in that. Like, as soon as something becomes formalised or there's going to be, you know, any sort of publicity about it, you've got to just be in total control. And I try and do that across everything I do. You know, I only like to be in... I try not to do too much stuff. I genuinely try not to do too many podcasts. Yeah. I like to know what I'm going to say. Yeah. And I like to sort of try and manage it. And... we just didn't really have any control over that show at all. It wasn't even made by the production company that made The Inbetweeners. It was made by a different production company. And, those shows, I think, are always pretty terrible because they're sort of navel-gazing and saying that what you've done deserves to be remembered and sort of people being sort of nostalgic about it. It always makes me feel very uneasy it's just very cringy, isn't it?
It's true, but... because it's the show itself was exactly what it was. You can like that or dislike that as a format. The problem came, and as you touched there, is how it was promoted and marketed as if it was something other. It wasn't pushed as, honestly, we're just all getting together and having a bit of a catch up. It's not that big a deal.
They had all, there was like an awards ceremony aspect to it that wasn't very funny and it was not a fun thing to be a part of.
Well, I mean, we could move on. I feel I've dredged it up and now we're going to spend a chunk of the podcast on it.
It's fine. It's just very, I think it's good for people to know how these things happen as well. Like, it's also very difficult because like when there's four of us and you're seen as a group, if three people sign up and agree to do it, and you're the fourth person. I'm not saying this is what happened, but this is just one of the dynamics you have to deal with. It's like, if what's going to happen? The show still might happen, and it just looks like you've refused to do it, and that is like a weird thing. And people will say, "Oh, they've fallen out, and they're not friends, and all that sort of thing."
Yeah, who wants to be the Jerry Halliwell? That's just
totally.
It's a tough situation.
You're suddenly part of... What's weird when a show becomes that big is that you become part of a brand and you suddenly have all these jobs you have to do as brand ambassador.
Yeah.
That was not what you originally signed up for.
I completely understand, and it gives you such a weird and unfair responsibility for other people. Because again, I've had that in music in the past. When I decided to stop making music, it wasn't necessarily at the same time as my musical partner had decided to stop making music, but I then had to have the guilt or the burden of, right, well, I've stopped the part of the career that was the two of us. I've chosen to stop that, but that's not what you should be taking into account for your own artistic endeavours. And similarly, you don't want to be the one to break up the in-betweeners or whatever else, but at some point that show had to end, so any of you would have been well in your right to go, look, shall we call it a day? But you kind of had to wait for all of you to say, call it a day. Yeah. So you get pulled along, and it's like, this isn't fair. This is an unfair pressure.
Yeah. I mean, like I said at the beginning, really, these are all very sort of petty grumbles about something that has been really great for me, and I'm really happy to have been a part of.
I mean, how do you keep... I'm going somewhere with this, but how do you keep your ego in check? Because it's unusual, incredibly unusual, to be in one kind of cult classic TV show, but A Friday Night Dinner is another one that is just, it's amazing. So to be in two of these kind of classic ensemble piece type shows is amazing. So how was that to be part of, and was there any kind of you going, you know what, as soon as that blew up, did you have to check yourself at any point going, you know what, I think it might be me. I think I might be the key here. This is me.
No, I mean, just not at all. And I think if you speak to anyone who works in the TV industry, they'll say the same. In that, like, really, the bit where you feel like pampered and you know, king of the worldy is filming, where you're totally infantilized and you get driven to set and you get brought whatever food you want, and you've got sort of runners who you'll say, oh, I'd ask you what newspapers and magazines you want in the green room. And that's great. But, you know, that really, filming a series lasts 6 weeks, and then you're home and you've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old to look after, and there's a global pandemic. So my day-to-day life is not affected by that at all. I do the filming job, I forget about it, and I start trying to think of ideas that I can make for TV and or film. And then the shows come out, and there's like, I'd say on the day it comes out and you see that it's got great viewing figures, obviously you get a little buzz of satisfaction, and that's really nice. And it's nice when people come up to you on the street, but it doesn't happen that often.
Yeah.
And, you know, really most of my year is just being a self-employed man at home with children, trying to write stuff.
So how is that? Because you've said there with acting, you have this period when you're doing it, and then you come home and it's over, and you move on. That's not quite the same with directing, right? Because there is a longer. No, you're the one that's in control for that bit longer. So how was that as a transition with family life as well? That you rap.
Well, that's what.
And normally,
rap so nice
is when you get your wife gets her husband back, your kids get their dad back. But with a director, you rap, and there's an ongoing balance to be made.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, it's great because it's just it's intense and it's lots of work, but it's spread over a long old period of time.
Yeah,
you know. The first discussions about making this film were probably like 4 or 5 years ago. So really, again, like the only time I was really like just away and not contactable for my wife and kids was the 4 weeks that we shot it.
Yeah.
Everything else was just sort of meetings here and there and going to the edit. But you can do that in more normal working hours.
Of course, of course. Another weird experience that Friday Night Dinner gave me, one of the quite rightfully standout performances is from Paul Ritter. He's absolutely amazing.
It's incredible.
A tour de force in it, and I probably had seen him in other things, but I don't particularly remember him in other things until that. So that's where I identify him from, which meant that when I was later watching globally acclaimed bleak disaster biopic Chernobyl, it was kind of like, who's that? Wait, That's it's surely that's. Do you think there's something in those actors who are able to do great comedy and great drama that allow them to do comedy in such a standout manner rather than just here's a comedian or whatever else? Because Monica Dolan, again, as we've said, has that Olivia Colman quality of she can be the funniest thing in a show and then the next time she can just be the most dramatic. Do you feel there's a key crossover there?
Yeah, totally. I think I would say this, obviously, I'm biased. I'm really not talking about myself. But I think comedy actors just make really great dramatic actors. Because yeah. I think all the skills you need for comedy, totally empathy and warmth and all of that, and at times sort of biting cynicism, all of that is required for drama as well. And it's strange now that I feel like in the sort of the heyday of the independent film world, you know, in the 70s, there wasn't really a distinction between like drama actors and comedy actors. You know, you see like somebody like Dustin Hoffman could be totally hilarious in Tootsie and then equally brilliant in much darker roles as well. So no, I think with Paul, it was like what I loved about the casting of Paul for Friday Night Dinner was that he wasn't like a established comedy dame. Mm. He was a amazingly highly regarded theatre actor. And I think the casting director just really, really pushed him. Said, I've seen this guy in so many plays. I know he can do it. Please give him a chance. And yeah, he's obviously just incredible.
What were your... I'll start to wrap things up now as I want to let you get back to your family. Or I want them to be allowed back in the house. I know they're sat on the doorstep.
It's all right.
It's getting colder out there.
Let's keep this going. I've got all day.
So... What were your kind of, or what are your influences from a film and TV point of view as a director, as even as an actor in the kind of things that you want to do? What are the things, like you've said, that you adored being involved in The Inbetweeners, as it's given you all these things you wouldn't have been able to have before, but it's not necessarily what you would have written or what you would have chosen to make as your own project. So what are those kind of influences and things like that?
Well, I think it's changed over the years. You know, when I was at school, I was just the biggest fan of sitcoms and, you know, especially The Office came out when I was 16 and was like the most formative thing for me. And then when I was at university, because I was starting to do comedy, I was really into live comedy and stand-up and, you know, would obsessively go and watch Stuart Lee and, you know, Tim Key and, and you're not allowed to say his name anymore, but Louis C.K.
Yeah.
And I think then as I sort of got sort of work in TV and film and became more interested in how stuff is made, that's when I sort of got into films a bit more and sort of got to know different directors' back catalogues.
Mm.
And, you know, that I think Days of the Bang on Summer came out of that, and that's sort of still where I'm at, is I think now, if I have spare time, which is not that often, I will sit down and watch a film, probably, rather than anything else. And I guess those names are like, a lot of them are probably quite old. I'm obsessed with this director called Elaine May, who made this film called The Heartbreak Kid, which is just amazing. And a lot of her sort of contemporaries, like Peter Bogdanovich and Hal Ashby, sort of the American directors of the 70s.
They were all people who managed to tell stories of youth really truthfully, but still dramatically and still big and still impactful, but just really in capturing that,
they just really have an innate sense of humour.
Yeah.
And that, even when they're making very serious films, you can't escape that it's funny.
Yeah.
And they just see the humour in everything. And I like that. Those are the sort of films that I love to watch. I need there to be a bit of relief.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I think that's what I'd really love to do, is I'd love to have the opportunity to try and make another film. And, as we were discussing earlier, I think there was a cynical aspect of, there's a degree to which it has to be sort of connected in publicity terms to The Inbetweeners.
Yeah.
and it has to be set in England and be able to film it in London for not very much money at all.
Yeah.
So hopefully for the next film, some of those will be lifted a little bit and I can do something a bit different.
I love that as well, because it's you've touched upon something there with the actors, but with films in general, that we've got to a place in more recent history where it is so based on, and I think it's partly because of the different commissioning departments. It's so much, well, is it comedy or is it drama or is it this or is it that? Is it horror? Is it? And some of the best films, particularly from the 60s, 70s and so on, it sounds so pretentious to say, is it comedy or drama? Go, watch it and you decide. You tell me, kind of thing. But that's what it was. The dramas always had some comedy and light relief in there. And comedies, the best of them, hit you with drama when you weren't expecting it and really made you relate to those characters and make it more of a experience rather than it being such a clear-cut divide of, here's the drama, so this is the one that's going to be up for awards, here's the comedy. People will enjoy this but not give it any artistic merit because it's comedy. And do you know what I mean? I think the blurring of those lines is a beautiful thing.
And I think that was there in... I said about The Office being so formative for me. I think that was there in The Office, to be honest. 100%. I think it was the first one of those sitcoms where you're like, oh, God, this is actually how people really talk to each other.
Yeah.
And, like, that Tim is sad. Like, he's sad about how boring his life is. And you know, David Brent... I've met that person.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. I think comedy is definitely its best when it's like recognisable and real.
Completely. So to finish things off, what are your plans going forward? Is directing the focus? Is acting in other people's work still something that excites you, or are you in a period where you'd rather write? Because again, a lot of first time directors, particularly who have built a name in acting, will put themselves in a film because, again, it can help get the financing and stuff like that. But you've chosen to go against that. What are your plans going forward with regards to all of the rambling I've just done?
I'll do whatever. I'm a whore. I don't know. I definitely want to keep directing just because I loved it so much. But that is definitely not... I'm not closing the door on acting. It's more that acting can close the door on me. I'm obviously up for... I'll always read scripts if they come in.
Yeah.
But they very rarely do. And then, I don't know, I just sort of toying around with the idea of maybe doing a bit of stand-up or...
Great.
But I have been toying around with that for years and never quite... have the courage to do it. Mm. So yeah,
it's tough with all those things because generally with stand up, when people start, they're shit, but there's no one there to see it. They're playing to three people in the room. Whereas if you're starting and you're already a name, then you've not got that comfort blanket of I can be shit while no one's looking, and then by the time they're looking, I can be great. You've kind of got to find a way to get to great or at least pretty damn good immediately, which is a hell of a pressure.
You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah, you've got a that is a big problem.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. And
worries, it's been great.
I look forward to seeing whatever is ahead and being in the crowd if you do any absolutely shit stand-up gigs to try and to try and support.
It
was good. It was good. It was good. It was all right. It was fine. It was fine.
Yeah, I liked. There was one bit I liked. What was it?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for doing a somewhat rare podcast appearance as well. So yeah, nice.
Oh, no worries.
And all the best for the strange ongoing times in which we live.
Yes, ditto.
Excellent. We'll see you soon, man. Have a good one.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 329. Thank you for tuning in. I forgot to mention in the intro, I did an Instagram Live that turned into a bonus podcast. So if you go back, not the last episode, the episode before of the Pod Bible podcast, it's myself and Jordan, who is the online editor of Pod Bible, discussing changes that we feel we need to make and areas in which we feel we've fallen short. It's a very honest and frank and open discussion. So I'd love it if you went and gave it a listen. It's the bonus episode. It will say Pod Bible bonus episode. So yeah, in general, check the Pod Bible podcast out. It's great. I love being involved in it. But that episode in particular is an in-depth and honest and open chat. And there's a really good bit about cakes. All right. I will see you all on Friday and next week. So yeah, tons more to come. We're keeping busy in lockdown. All right, see you soon. Thank you for tuning in. Bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.